Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Swing and a line drive, base in right field. Max Scherzer has done it again.
Do you believe it, Howie Kendrick, part two?
The celebration is on. The Washington Nationals are the world champions.
Welcome into another edition of the Nats podcast. Chase Houston, Divis, Nick Ashy with you. Guys, I feel like every time we do this podcast and every time we talk, there's like five different things that's changed with baseball as they just continue to battle and how they're going to have some semblance of a season. The thing that's really stood out, we've certainly looked at it briefly before on this, but it's starting to become a glaring issue with baseball, and it's the concept of perception, right? Like, perception is reality right now. If you're baseball, when you're looking at the NBA has a return plan in place, you have the NHL, which is in really the same position, and you have baseball, who's clearly not in the same position as those sports, but fans, people are lumping it all together and watching them continue to fight over money and how many games they're going to play and when it's going to be and all those things. And it's really hurting the image of the sport right now. Whether it's fair or not, that's just the reality of the situation.
Yeah, things are different for baseball because they don't have a regular season in the books, right? But as you said, this isn't really typically a nuanced conversation. It's why aren't these guys getting their act together and getting back on the field, especially because we've seen a lot of movement in Texas in particular about facilities and fans and some ideas down there that will actually undermine the arguments that different sides are making, that we're going to lose revenue here and the players are worried about this. And well, if you're going to have some fans and you're going to be able to play in regular stadiums, in Texas in particular, then maybe there's actually a better way forward that will quell some of your, in particular, revenue issues. But they're going to keep knocking this around. There's a new proposal that MLB has made to players, according to multiple reports, as we kind of chat here on Monday. Now it's up to a 76-game season with 75% prorated salary. The season would finish September 27th, postseason end of October. So that's in a normal calendar parameters, and it's probably where I think a lot of people thought we were going to end up anyway, because going from the 50 games that the league kind of said we're in control of schedule, if we're going to do prorated salaries, we're going to do 50 games, and the players wanted 114. Well, guess what's in the middle? 82. So now they're at 76 from the league. The owners know the more games without fans, the more money they lose. The players know the more games, period, the more money they make. So, and then the postseason is what everybody is looking to cash in on, and they're trying to find the best way they can to assure that that happens, or come as close to being sure that happens as possible. So sounds like we're heading toward kind of a half a season scenario, and that might just have to be acceptable to everyone this year.
Yeah, my ultimate guess is that that's where they end up, is somewhere around 80, 90 games. 50 is far too few. I don't think they're going to get over 100, so that does seem like a sweet spot. In terms of the optics, I can really tell that people are starting to get tired of it. If you look at social media and sort of just the juxtaposition of all that's going on in the world, obviously a pandemic, obviously protests in pretty much every major U.S. city, and then here is Major League Baseball and its Players Association going through this public PR battle, which is not about safety anymore. It's about money. And it seems like, you know, me as a cynical reporter, the way I see it is there's these sort of strategic media leaks from both sides. And I think people are starting to not really like watching that play out. And it kind of reminds me of You guys know the meme of like the little girl on the swing set and there's like a burning building behind her?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it kind of signifies like being oblivious. That it reminds me of that. And it's also like, it's like Major League Baseball doesn't have their eye on the ball right now. It's like Nigel Morgan in center field when he's throwing his glove down to the ground and the ball's still in play. I'm sure Nationals fans remember that one.
And Stammen stays from the stretch, and Adam hits it high to center field, pretty deep. Nigel Morgan back near the wall. He reaches up. He can't make the play, and he fires his glove towards the ground. One run is in. Adam Jones may have an inside the park home run. He's being sent. Here's the throw to the plate. He is safe at the plate, and inside the park home run for Adam Jones. And the Orioles now have a 4-2 lead. And Nigel Morgan, upset at not catching it instead of going after the ball, may have cost his team a run.
Yeah. But
I bring that Morgan here on a Monday.
Tony Plush. But it's a real shame because I feel like baseball had or maybe still has a distinct opportunity to be the first major U.S. sport to return. They were looking at July 4th, and right now that's starting to seem more and more unrealistic. But as of now, it seems like the NBA might be the first sport back, right? July 31st.
Yeah.
And it would just seem a little bit fitting, I think, if baseball could be the first sport to come back because of how deeply rooted it is in U.S., you know, sports history. It's such a tradition, but also how it's been played through so many moments of U.S. history along the way. You know, it's been around a long time, and including, we all remember, you know, after 9/11, baseball returning, especially in New York City, and that being a very powerful moment. So it would be great if baseball could come back, and I think they need to come back one way or the other, because if they don't, then that's going to be a really, really bad look if they have to punt on an entire season.
It would really hurt the sport, because they'd already be playing behind and having to deal with getting attention from dealing, you know, the NFL is going to be playing, and then you've got the NBA and NHL playing meaningful postseason games. So if you're baseball and you are playing games, you already have to deal with that. If you're not playing, you're even more out of the public eye. And I know a lot of people are comparing this to the 94 strike. This is just so different in terms of what we're dealing with and what the world is dealing with now than what was certainly going on then. But if you look at it, fair or not, you break it down to just being millionaires and billionaires fighting over money. Fans have never liked that. But we've seen plenty of other sports go through CBA negotiations before, and that's just – fans don't like it, but you do kind of get a little numb to it when it's something standard like that. But with the way the world is now, it's made it far more complicated for them, with so many people that don't have jobs or have lost jobs and then put in a position where they're watching this. And it's just, it gets to the point where you brought it up, Chase, you're right. Like, people are just tired of it. It's to the point where your eyes gloss over, you move on and say, well, I'm going to pay attention to these other sports that are willing to come back. And that's something that baseball has to think of. In the end, I think they're going to play a season, whatever that season is. I think it's going to be something. There's too much money to be lost, because can you imagine going from that last out in the World Series to not playing any baseball whatsoever again until, what, March or April 2021? That's devastating to the sport.
Yeah, you know what, Nick? Also, I'll throw in, it's becoming to me seemingly less about the other sports and in the last 10 days what has happened in the country. Right? Like, why people are very focused on that, as they should be. And that has also changed the tenor around mm-hmm. this as far as interest or level of matter, right? Like, I agree with Chase that the September 11th situation was a powerful moment with Piazza and all that. It feels different. It feels like it would be like, all right, well, baseball returned. Fantastic. But we have much, much bigger things to deal with, and we are dealing with them, thankfully, you know, in some capacity. So that climate has changed, which is a negative for baseball as well. And also another optics negative is to come in the winter, because all the winter is going to be about is probably suppress free agency and the 2021 CBA, and it's going to be I can already see the stories I'm writing. It's going to be, you guys bickered all summer, and now it's the winter, and they're bickering again about what's going to happen next winter, and the owners aren't paying anyone. And last year, the winter meetings were good because Anthony Rendon, Steven Strasburg, you know, things were happening, right? And it felt like we got out of that malaise of the Bryce Harper, Manny Machado offseason. But this winter is going to be ugly as well. So they're kind of like bookending themselves with this bad juju, if you will. And there's a lot more important things going on in the world simultaneously. So I think that idea that they were leaning on heavily at the start of this of, well, Rob Manfred said this, right? Like, his, almost as soon as spring training was shut down, his first appearance when he showed up on ESPN, I think it was on SVP, and he said that we're going to be part of the healing for the country. Yeah, I don't know so much anymore, right? Like, that concept was based around the coronavirus pandemic and the shutdown and everybody kind of feeling antsy and fiending for some normalcy or something to take their distraction. And in this case, I think that moment has passed, and basically they're just trying to get their act together, have a season of some sort, get some enjoyment out of it if possible, and move on.
I would just like to point out that that was genuine pain by Todd Dybas right there, yeah. Mapping out the next 12 months of having to talk about those subjects over and over and over and over. But I think he's absolutely right. And, you know, if you look at the possibility of losing a full season, I don't think we're going to get there, but that would be really troublesome for baseball, because whatever minor slip you might see from year to year in TV ratings of national games or the World Series, I think you'd see that even more dramatically if they missed a whole year, because attention spans are just so short these days. And, you know, you need to get younger fans. And every year there's some number of young baseball fans or young sports fans that jump on to baseball. And you're talking about missing, you know, an entire school year of young kids, you know, kids in elementary school who are just figuring out which sports they like. And I think that that would have a noticeable effect long-term. Baseball already has enough trouble courting young fans, and I think that would be really, really difficult. You know, they might pick another sport. The kids who are playing Little League for the first time might not identify with the major league players like they usually do every year. So I don't think baseball is in a position where they can afford to just miss an entire year and then recover from that quickly in terms of popularity and fan interest.
Yeah, deep down, I think they realize that too. And that's why we've got this new 76-game season proposal that just came out. All right, real quick, let's each kind of go with a prediction here and what we think baseball is going to do. I think what just came out kind of makes the most sense. It feels the most down the middle to me in terms of 75% prorated salary. Todd, if that was your phone, you are grounded. You are in trouble. They're supposed to be on vibrate here. This is a big moment. I think the proposal that came out today, though, it feels to me some semblance of that, where players are getting majority of their money. Regular season ends at the end of September. A postseason runs till the end of October. 76 games. You know, they talked about 82. They talked about 50. All of this seems to make the most sense. It's a little bit more in terms of games. It's a lot of money still for players. This feels like something that's going to turn into some sort of agreement. Where are you guys?
Yeah, I think so. I feel like I've been writing this repeatedly, that this is the most logical thing. Heck, like, we were on this podcast, Chase, I don't know if you remember, but it was a month ago, 6 weeks ago, maybe, I think we started talking about July 4th and like half the season. So that has seemed to be the most logical thing the whole time. I think if they do half a season, you know, the front half, you probably won't have fans, or maybe you have them just in Texas or certain places. But maybe in the back half, you have some fans at that point, and you're able to make up some ground financially. It's going to be different. There's just no two ways about it. Everyone's going to have to kind of accept it and go forward. The only thing I'll add to this, though, Nick, real quick, is we seem to have forgotten the health protocol part of this.
Yeah.
Like, there was the 67-page document, and everyone looked at that and was like, this thing is thorough. But there's also a bunch of gaps, and there's no punishment mechanism, as we've gone over, and there's no daily testing, which is certainly problematic. And so that still needs to be figured out, right? Like, we just keep talking about the number of games. And I said this to someone in the industry, I think yesterday, and I was like, you know, you guys don't even have step one done. It's not like step one and two are complete and you're just trying to figure out step three. Step one and two are not done. So you're not even at step three yet. Like, and he was, you know, the same as me, kind of. I threatened the rest of my stories until this is over. It's going to be my byline. So it'll say, by Todd Dybas. Then it will just be the eye roll emoji. And then and then it will say 30 at the bottom. And that's what I'm going to try to send in from now on. Because that's how I feel like. I just keep writing the same thing because of how this is going.
Yeah, my guess is it's somewhere in the 80 to 90 game range. The postseason's expanded a little bit, and they get going in late July. I think as bleak as it looks like right now, and it won't be July 4th, it'll be 2 to 3 weeks after that because they'll have a wake-up call moment and realize that something's got to be done. And my big prediction is that the players are going to have to compromise salary-wise more than the owners, and they're going to have to give on their side.
All right, coming up, we're going to get Jim Callis's thoughts on baseball cutting that draft from 40 rounds down to just 5. That's another thing that's changed with all this. Plus, who he thinks the Nationals could select in the first round. That's coming up next on the Nats Talk Podcast.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
So, Jim, I want to start with the World Series champion Washington Nationals. Their minor league system, to me, looks like a pretty thin place. Obviously, Juan Soto and Victor Robles came out of there, and they are very, very big deals at this point. But when you run through there now, anticipating Carter Kieboom will be on the major league roster, there's not much beyond Luis Garcia, seemingly, and there's even less when you're talking about pitchers and starting pitchers. What is your view of the organization's minor league system at this point?
No, I mean, I think all that's fair. I mean, obviously, no complaints by any Nationals fans with the way the farm system you know, not only produced guys who helped them win a championship, but also produced players that they traded for guys who helped them win a championship. But you're right. I mean, the system is not particularly strong right now. You know, once Kieboom graduates, you're looking at Garcia. You know, I like Jack Rutledge a lot, last year's first-round pick, although he obviously hasn't really done much. And then after that, I mean, there's not a lot of guys who are going to provide immediate help. I mean, Will Crow is getting close, and I think he's fine, but he's not – you know, nobody's screaming that Will Crow isn't on a top 100 prospects list right now. We've wronged him or anything. It is a thin system, you know, which, I mean, typically – you see that when you have contending teams. You know, generally it's all about, you know, getting players to the big league level, you getting players to use in trades, and the farm system sometimes gets a little thin. And I think that is what they're going through right now.
Jim, what was your like main takeaway and reaction when you heard that Major League Baseball was going to cut the rounds of their draft down this year from 40 all the way down to 5 as an effect from coronavirus? What was your takeaway from that?
I was really disappointed, and I'm not going to just – I work for MLB technically, but I'm not going to just blame MLB. The union let them do it. The union doesn't care about the draftees. I mean, basically the way it went down was MLB, the owners did not want to have a draft at all this year. The union said, no, you have to have a draft, but as long as it's 5 rounds, feel free to screw the players however you want, and that's kind of what happened, unfortunately. You know, I think it's the part that's really short-sighted about it is you could have had a 10-round draft, and that would have cost each team an extra $1 million a team total. I'm not talking about upfront. I'm just talking about total. You know, more than 90% of the bonus money from this year is getting deferred. The teams together can only pay – you can only pay guys $100,000 this year, and the rest of it's deferred over 2 years. So the teams between them are going to spend about $500,000 each on this year's draft, and you wouldn't have had to pay the guys in round 6 or 10 upfront. I also think it's unfortunate that they're limiting – the amount of money you could pay a non-drafted player to $20,000. Last year, there were almost 400 players who were deemed worthy of six-figure signing bonuses who didn't get taken in the first 5 rounds. And now all those guys have to take $20,000 or go back to school. And, you know, look, I mean, I know the economy's hurting. MLB revenues are going to be way down. A lot of things going on. But especially with all the bonus money really being deferred, I actually thought it was kind of short-sighted. Hopefully I'll still have my job after saying all that. But I mean, the draft is the most cost efficient way to get talent. Like I think every team would tell you that. And you control, once you draft the player and you sign him, you lock him up for you. You control his rights for 6 years in the minors and 6 years in the majors, and, you know, can pay these guys a fraction of what they would earn on the open market until they're eligible for free agency and arbitration. I think it's going to hurt baseball a little bit too. I mean, it hurts a lot of people. I think it's going to hurt teams. You're going to have a year where you really aren't signing players, very many players. And that's, you know, I think for a team like the Nationals, it hurts because you know, you're looking to add depth to your farm system, and you're really not going to be able to do that this year.
Yeah, and it'll be funny to see what everybody does with their international spending. Somehow I feel like they're magically going to find some cash there.
Well, you know, that's getting pushed off too. Like it sounds like, I mean, this isn't official yet, but it sounds like that's not going to happen until January. And I mean, I'm just speculating here. I don't know the details of this, but I'm going to guess if they deferred all the draft bonus money, they're going to try to defer the international signing money, which is going to get tricky because you have the trainers in these countries have been housing and feeding and training players and expecting a big cash payout when they sign. And I don't know how if some of those deals possibly fall through. If instead of paying a guy $2 million up front, you're telling him, oh, well, here's $100,000, and we'll get you $950,000 next year, and we'll get you $950,000 the year after that. Some of these trainers might not look upon that too kindly. So we'll see. That's going to be a mess too.
What we do know, one of the few things we do know, is that the Nationals pick 22nd in the upcoming draft. So, Jim, what do you see happening there? Obviously, we've been talking about the limited pitching staff that exists in the minor leagues for the Nationals right now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard to project what's going to happen in 22, but I feel fairly confident saying there's a very good chance they're going to take a college pitcher with that pick. One, I mean, they've taken a lot of college pitchers with high picks recently. Two, that's by far the strength of this draft. So even though we don't know exactly how the 21 picks ahead of them are going to play out, there's so much college pitching depth in this draft that I think that's a safe bet. And most of the names I've heard with them have been college pitchers, you know, guys like, you know, Cole Wilcox from Georgia, you know, Chris McMahon from Miami, Clayton Beter from Texas Tech, Kate Cavalli from Oklahoma is a guy who I think they really like, who probably doesn't quite get to them. You know, Bobby Miller from Louisville. You go on and on and on. There's a lot of pitching names. And so, again, we'll see if I get any of those right, but it seems like college pitching is what they're going to.
The last mock draft I saw you do, you had Clayton Beter going to the Nationals, and I saw you mention that he's Tommy John veteran. Of those guys, is he the one to watch in terms of fitting that formula for the Nats, where it's like a guy who maybe has Tommy John surgery who probably would be picked higher if it weren't for the injury history?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the injury history is so much. Well, I mean, it is and it isn't. Like, the problem with Beter when you're trying to figure out where to put him is there's just not much track record. You know, he didn't pitch as a freshman after having Tommy John surgery. Then as a redshirt freshman, he pitched 20 innings in relief and was the closer for Texas Tech, College World Series team, but didn't throw a lot of strikes. And then he came out this year and he only pitched about 20 innings and 4 starts, but he was pounding the strike zone with well above average fastball, slider, curveball. I mean, the stuff's crazy. So, yeah, I mean, he could. I mean, Cole Wilcox is – and I think a lot of other mocks have put Cole Wilcox here. I just can't – I keep having Cole Wilcox come off the board before he gets to 22, to be honest. I think he's the name we hear the most. And like I said, you know, Kate Cavalli – I mean, all these guys are right-handed power pitchers with good size, you know, 6'4", 6'5", you know, just nasty stuff. You know, Clayton Beter's a little bit shorter. He's more 6'2", but he's strong. He's 6'2", 220. You know, Cavalli is the guy who I think is kind of their wish list of who they'd really like to get, but probably doesn't get to them. Although last year we were saying the same thing about Jackson Rutledge. You know, Nationals picked 17th. Didn't seem like Rutledge was going to get out of the first 10 or 11 picks. And I kept hearing, oh, the Nationals really want Rutledge, but they're not going to get him, and they got him. So maybe they can get luck with Kate Cavalli this year.
Jim, you just mentioned just not seeing somebody. There wasn't much of a track record for someone there. And so how has losing the spring affected scouting projections for this draft and all that other stuff? Obviously, people start to get watched when they're very young, you know, freshman year and up, if not in some insane cases, if not sooner. But how has the pandemic and shutting down everything influenced the process here of trying to figure out who is going where and these teams trying to get eyes on guys once again to help their decision making?
I mean, I think teams are in better shape than the average fan might think because you do so much scouting the previous summer. You know, the high school guys, you're watching them on the showcase circuit against the best competition. College guys, you're watching in summer leagues with Team USA, wood bats, better competition. So they got a lot of looks at guys last summer. Now, obviously, they would like to have another, you know, couple months to evaluate players this spring, which didn't happen. So there's been more video scouting. They're kind of looking at the same stuff over and over again. I feel like they feel – like at least teams I've talked to, I mean, the general attitude seems to be, okay, this isn't optimal, but like we do have a lot of data. We do have a lot of looks. We're making the best of it. We're going to be okay. I mean, next year next year could be tough because I don't know how many showcases and how many summer leagues we're really going to have this season. There's still plans to try to have some later in the summer, but you might be going into next year with almost no looks at guys, especially on the high school side, which will be tough. Yeah, you know, and from trying to figure out where guys are going to go in the draft, there's less, intel this year because guys aren't, scouts and agents aren't just running into each other casually at baseball games and having conversation, talking about what might happen, and you aren't seeing, Mike Rizzo showed up at this game of this college player. He wouldn't be there if he wasn't interested. We aren't getting that. I mean, I had a scout director tell me early on, and he was right that we're trying to parse the tea leaves of okay, who was on the Zoom meeting? Was it the scouting director and like an area guy, or was like a GM on there or AGM, and was like a pitching coordinator? It's almost like the more members of the organization who are on the Zoom call and the higher up they rank, then you're like, okay, like they do like that guy because the GM was involved. Like we're kind of reduced to that. But yeah, it's been different. I mean, it has been different for sure.
I want to ask you about Spencer Torkelson, first baseman from Arizona State, expected to go number one overall to the Detroit Tigers. And you had some really high praise of him, saying that he might be the draft's best all-around offensive prospect since Mark Teixeira in 2001. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think everybody focuses on the power first with Torkelson. Because, he broke Barry Bonds' freshman home run record at Arizona State. And he led Pac-12 in each of his two full seasons. And if the season, when the season ended this year prematurely, he was only two home runs away from Bob Horner's career record at Arizona State. And so everybody focuses on the power. And I almost think that overshadows just his all-around brilliance as a hitter. He is the best power hitter in this draft. He's also one of the best just pure hitters as well. And he's got some of the best plate discipline. This isn't, a lot of times with your best power guys, it's guys who are, grip it and rip it and trying to pull everything out of the park and, max effort swing. And that's not Torkelson. I mean, he can hit the ball out of the park to all fields without trying to hit the ball out of the park. And, I've had numerous, directors and cross checkers and evaluators tell me, they've seen at bats where he's down 0-2 and they throw him a slider on the outside corner and he just goes the other way and hits it out of the park. I mean, I had one scouting director tell me he thought he was the best, most major league ready hitter he's ever seen. This guy's been doing it for a long time, coming out of the draft. And another guy said he thought you could put him in the big leagues right now. And you don't hear that hyperbole as much on that he thought, I don't think Detroit would do that if they take him number one, because it wouldn't make sense with the service time considerations. But like they said, he's the best first baseman Detroit's going to have as soon as they take him. And as a bonus, I mean, Arizona State's got a crazy, crazy good infield defensively. They might have the best, literally the best defensive third baseman, shortstop, and second baseman in college baseball. You could argue that. And I'm not saying Torkelson's, going to play shortstop, but there's a chance Torkelson could play third base or left field. So you might even get more, defensive value out of him than you're thinking. And if he's a first baseman only, fine, because like you said, what I said about the Teixeira, I mean, this is the best guy's have seen in a long time. I mean, I know Chris Bryant's been thrown around a little bit, and I'm not saying like, oh, slam dunk, he's better than Chris Bryant, but at the same stage, there were swing and miss concerns with Chris Bryant. There aren't swing and miss concerns with Spencer Torkelson. And I really do feel like, you have to probably go back to Teixeira to find a guy who had that much hitting ability and power and plate discipline all in one package. And, there's never been a right-handed hitting first baseman who's gone number one overall in the draft. And that's going to change this year because he's so unique.
So let's slide a spot and talk about our friends up the road, the Baltimore Orioles, who will be picking number two as they try to continue their reconstruction of what was a very stable and competitive organization and is now in this ongoing rebuild. Number two, what do you see happening for the Orioles and them prioritizing there?
Yeah, it's with them. They could kind of go in a couple different directions. I think if somehow Detroit didn't take Spencer Torkelson, I think Baltimore would take him, and that would be an easy decision. Assuming he goes number one, the guy who I think, if you're just going purely on talent, the favorite might be Vanderbilt's Austin Martin. He's the best pure hitter in this year's draft. He led the SEC in hitting and on base percentage last year as Vanderbilt won the national title. The question, it's a little bit of a question. He's athletic, but like you play him defensively. Your scouts were hoping to see him at short, and he didn't get a chance to play short this year. Started the season at third. His throwing wasn't great. He looked a little tentative, so they put him in center field. You're probably talking offensive second baseman or center fielder, real good hitter. So he'd be the guy, I think, if you're just purely doing it on talent. But because it's a baseball draft, you have these bonus pools, and you factor in, you know, sometimes can we save money and take a similar player and have more money to do something later? You know, there's a school of thought that the Orioles might take a deal with a guy, you know, save some money, save a little bit of money, and maybe not sacrifice that much talent. And there have been hitters like New Mexico State middle infielder Nick Gonzalez, who's not that dissimilar from Austin Martin, has been mentioned. Heston Kerstad, who's a left-handed power hitter out of Arkansas, an outfielder. Zach Fien, who's the best high school prospect in the draft. They've been kind of bandied about. And, you know, the Orioles, you know, when Michael Elias was with the Astros, they played everything super close to the vest, more than any team with the draft, and they kind of still do that. So even though we have an idea who they're looking for, I'm on the fence. I don't know whether to say they're going to take Austin Martin or that they're going to maybe go a little different direction and save a little bit of money. Now, they don't really have to save money to go big later in the draft because they have the largest bonus pool. They're more like $13.6 million, more than anybody else has. And their second pick at number 30 comes before anybody else's second pick. And their third pick at number 39 comes before anybody else's third pick. So they kind of are, you know, they could take Austin Martin and still do a lot of damage with those picks anyway. So it's a little hard to figure out which of those paths we think they're going to take. I do think they're going hitter. I haven't really heard that they would take Asa Lacy, the best pitcher in this draft, the Texas A&M lefty. I think it's a hitter, you know, probably a college hitter. But like I said, I just don't know. That's on my weekend projects. Continue to dig. Are they taking Austin Martin, or are they going to maybe try to save a little bit of money there?
As the Orioles look at the second overall pick, how does this year's group compare to other years? Is this a draft where you'd say, hey, there's so much talent at the top that you can't really go wrong? Or is it a generally thin class or average? How would you kind of rate this draft class?
I think it's an above average draft class. I think the college pitching is exceptionally strong. I think the college hitters are a good group. I think high schools, you know, pale in comparison to the colleges, but they aren't bad. You know, it's kind of an average year maybe for high school, maybe even slightly above average. So I think it's a good draft. Yeah, I mean, personally, if I were picking two, I would hope for Spencer Torkelson. Like to me, I'd clearly take him number one. But there are a number of good players. You know, and even if you want to go the pitching route, you could go Lacy. You know, you could go Emerson Hancock from Georgia. You know, there's a lot of good options at two. This isn't a draft where – like everybody wants Spencer Torkelson and then it's like, what do we do now? Like, I think they are going to get a very good player. Now, I do think comparing to last year when they had the number one pick and they took Adley Rutschman, I do think whoever they take will not necessarily be as good as Adley Rutschman, but that's a pretty high bar to clear.
Jim, so the way you laid out the Orioles possible, the slots that they're in, and that this is just a 5-round draft this year and they're relying so heavily on the draft to reconstruct things, how much weight do you put on what they have to do coming up in this draft in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, one, you have the number two pick in the draft, and two, you have the largest bonus pool and you have earlier picks than anybody else. You're in the position to have, you know, the best draft anybody can have, and it is important. You know, anytime you're picking at two, you know, your team is coming off a horrible year. Generally, things are not good, and, you know, Baltimore has a lot of work to do. So, look, they're not going to hit on every pick. Nobody does that. But, yes, I mean, they have a golden opportunity here, and they need to take advantage of it because you just don't get these opportunities very often where they have, you know, the number two pick, the largest pool, three picks before anybody else has three and before most teams even make their second pick. So, yeah, they need to come out and have – draft, you know, to continue. The reality of it is if you don't have a good draft, and I think they're in position to, and there's no reason to think they wouldn't, but if you don't take advantage of this opportunity, then it's a setback, especially in a year where you only have five picks. It's not like you're gonna, you know, hit on an eighth rounder and make up for it. You know, they do need to have a good draft because they're just not, you know, teams are not getting the opportunity to do much, and they obviously have a lot of rebuilding to do.
Which teams, and maybe more specifically, which general managers have kind of impressed you the most in recent years with how they've handled the draft and the players they've been able to pick?
Yeah, I mean, and different GMs have different levels of involvement. I mean, I think the Padres have done a nice job in recent years. You know, they've been really aggressive internationally as well. The Dodgers are a team that stands out to me. You know, the Dodgers – are usually picking at the bottom of the first round and have smaller bonus pools because they have so much major league success. But yeah, they continue to, you know, get good players. And, you know, they got Walker Buehler in the 20s. They got Gavin Lux in the 20s. They continue to just, even though they're winning at the big league level, you know, continue to generate talent. So they're a team that really stands out to me. I think the Rays have done some nice work. You know, they've won the better farm systems around. So those would be three teams, I think, in the last couple of years that have really stood out to me.
And last, Jim, you mentioned Adley Rutschman earlier. When you look back on kind of all the hype surrounding him and the process there and all of that, anything particular jump to mind? Did you think it was all warranted? Was it fun? Was it not fun? Was it too much? What do you think about that process as you have some time to reflect?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it was definitely awarded with Adley. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, so I always do these historical perspectives. You know, this guy's the best since that, this or that, like we're talking about with Torkelson. And, you know, with Rutschman, I talked to a bunch of scouts, you know, kind of in the single draft era going back to 1987, where there's just one draft in June. Like, how's he stack up? And my conclusion from talking to people was, this is the best catching prospect of that period of the last 30-plus years that I've been covering it. You know, it's, you know, I don't know if you guys remember, there was talk like, oh, there might be something going on with his shoulder. You know, what's going on? And I think that was overblown. And that was like some negotiating posturing maybe. But I remember talking to a scouting director who picked very high, but he was not going to get a chance at Rutschman last year. And he said, look, you know, if there's something wrong with Adley Rutschman's shoulder and he can only play first base, then he's Mark Teixeira. I know I keep throwing Mark Teixeira out, you know, good local product there from the Baltimore. But he said, look, that's what we're talking about. It's like, if he's first base only, then I think he's Mark Teixeira. And that's a pretty good player. And so you're talking about, you know, Mark Teixeira offensive upside. And, oh, by the way, he might be a gold glove type catcher. Like, that's pretty special. So I think all the hype was warranted. I think the, you know, the draft record, $8.1 million bonus was warranted. So it'll be, you know, interesting to see with, you know, what happens with a major league season and taxi squads and that sort of thing. Like, you could argue perhaps, although there'd be service time implications, if, you know, there's going to be a severely curtailed or no minor league season, maybe Adley Rutschman should be on the Orioles taxi squad and get some playing time. Just, you know, I don't think he's too far removed from the majors to begin with. But that'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and they have nothing to lose other than another 100 games. So.
Well, they aren't going to lose 100 this year because they aren't going to play 100. So
yeah. There you go.
Well, they may not be able to lose one game at the rate these two sides are going. But we'll see. All right. Well, Jim, thanks so much for your time. Enjoy draft week. We really appreciate you stopping by and all the insight.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Great talking to you guys. And hopefully Nats and Orioles, we'll get some good ones when this comes up.
All right, so we are actually just past the 10-year anniversary of Steven Strasburg making his debut for the Nationals, and I still remember it so vividly. I actually wrote about it on NBCSportsWashington.com. It was cool because I actually just went as a fan. I just kind of started off doing this whole being in this sports media business. I was like, nope, don't want to do the no cheering in the press box. I'm actually going to go watch this game as a fan. I mean, it was incredible. But I feel like now you got to, after what happened in October, we do kind of have to update our biggest moments in Nationals Park history. I don't know, you can do a top three, you can do a top five, you guys want, whatever you have. I mean, there's certainly plenty of them. I think the Nats, for me, the number one now has to be the Nats sweeping the Cards and clinching. I mean, because clearly there weren't a lot of great World Series memories at Nats Park. But before that, that was certainly a great memory. Steven Strasburg's debut is still number two to me because of the hype, because of everything surrounding him and how excited everybody got. That's number two. And here's a wild card. And Chase, I think you'll like this. Teddy winning his first race back in 2012 should still be on that list, because all we ever did was hold him down and he finally won, and I was so happy to see that happen. I'll give honorable mention to Jason Wirth's walk-off, but Teddy winning his first race, got to be on that list. I'm putting it there. I'm doing it.
Yeah, the Strasburg debut, just because it had such national impact and it was part of the growth process for the organization, I'll put that as three. I will put Bryce Harper home run derby as two, because it was just a different moment. And it was like everybody at once finally embraced Harper, even if it was for one night, even though they knew that he was on his way out the door most likely. And Yeah, that night and like the way they've changed the home run derby and the way he came back and all that stuff, that was electric to me. And so number one for me actually is Juan Soto and winning the wild card game, because that was such a, like, I was so, when it was 3-1 and Hader was getting loose, I hate to say this, but I was sending text messages to friends like, tomorrow at noon I can play hoops because the season's over. And I was just going through, like, in my story, all the archival failures of the postseason as they pertain to this organization. And I was like, yeah, this was fun that they rallied to get to this point, but, you know, this is it. But then they finally got a hit. They finally got a broken bat single. They finally got a good bounce. And that, to me, kind of started everything that came afterwards. So I will pop it up there at number one. Especially since the World Series, huge moments, in like, because Howie's Grand Slam was in LA, right? And Howie's homer was in Houston. And
it felt like most of the best moments were like away from Nats Park. That's the worst part about it. Like, no, do some of that here.
Yeah, so those are my three. All right, Chase, we'll turn this over to you. Stop salivating.
Well, it is pretty amazing when you add them all up. All the moments that have happened in Nationals Park, considering the relatively brief history. You guys didn't even mention the no-hitters. My top three would be, number one is Strasburg's debut. Changing of the guard for the Nats as a franchise, and also just the hype and how he exceeded it. And I remember Bob Costas called it one of his top 10 sporting events that night. And that, to me, was pretty high praise coming from Bob Costas. I was also there as a fan. It was really fun. Secondly, number two, I have Scherzer's 20 strikeout game. That is the rarest feat in baseball history that's ever been accomplished at Nationals Park. Only four guys have done it. It's only happened five times. So I go with that one. You know, the playoffs, the World Series, those things technically happen every year in baseball. A 20 strikeout game does not. And third, I have the clinching game, because it was the best celebration ever inside the walls of Nationals Park. Obviously, the game itself wasn't that great. It was great for the Nationals. They scored seven runs in the first inning and just sort of held on and, you know, tried to run out the clock essentially to win. And it was just amazing, you know, watching them get the trophy and you know, be sent off to the World Series. So that would be my number three. But there's also just a lot of other ones that, you know, we didn't mention. The first World Series game since 1933, the Zimmerman walk-off on opening night. You mentioned Worth's walk-off homer, but also the All-Star game, that can be mentioned. And lastly, I'll just plug the fact that last year we did a full episode on Strasburg's debut, if you want to go back and check that out. But those would be my top three. Strasburg's debut, Scherzer's 20 strikeout games, and then game four of the NLCS in 2019.
All right, parting shot time. Chase, you didn't have a parting shot last time, so I expect something very strong from you, because this is your favorite thing to do, I know.
Well, I'll use my parting shot this week to announce that I'm officially a sour beers guy.
Whoa!
Never thought it would come to this. I remember trying one like 7 or 8 years ago and thinking it was disgusting. But I have acquired a taste for them, and now I can't get enough. And I have bought sour beers that were brewed with like watermelon, pineapple, blueberry, hibiscus, just like bizarre stuff that if you told me 10 years ago I would like, I would have not believed you. But basically, I feel like I'm becoming a very, very cliche. White guy in his 30s starts liking sour beers. That's
You just need a man bun and a beanie and you're good to go, Chase.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I'll be seeing you guys at the next Dave Matthews Band concert.
Hey, don't knock Dave Matthews Band. Come on.
It's good to know you're moving to Arlington, Chase. Enjoy.
I can't do the sour beers. So I would like to say I'm with you there, Chase, but I can't. You got a parting shot, Todd?
Nope. I don't.
Easy enough. That's all we need. All right. Well, make sure if you haven't subscribed yet to the podcast, subscribe wherever it is that you get your podcast. Thanks to Jim Callis, MLB.com. Follow us on all of the various socials. And at some point soon, hopefully, this podcast will be about real baseball games. And when that happens, it's going to be a whole lot better. We'll talk to you soon.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car right in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader, too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.